Thanks very much. Thanks for that lovely introduction. That was a great transition there.
I do what I can.
Bit of a shift in gear. I'm going to be talking about lessons for improving the informed consent process based on some work that my colleagues and I have conducted in Swaziland and Zambia. How do I control?
You can just use your arrow keys.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, well, I'll start off by saying a little bit about what this research study is and a little bit about what it isn't. This research takes a bit starting from the recent evidence from various randomized controlled trials that male circumcision has been found to be effective as an HIV prevention method, reducing the HIV risks by approximately 60% in certain settings. I don't want to enter into a discussion of those facts. That's the starting point for our research, and we're taking that that assumption as read. There's a whole world of controversy lies therein, but that is not the subject of this presentation. Subsequent to those findings from the randomized controlled trials, there have been various national and donor commitments to scaling up services implementing male circumcision in various settings of high prevalence of HIV and low prevalence of male circumcision. So it's within that context that we conducted some operations research investigating how best to do that. Just to outline what I'm going to speak about today, I'll outline some of our methods, the quantitative and qualitative research that we conducted to build a fuller picture of what's really going on in this, in the informed consent procedures for the scale-up of these interventions. I'll present to you some of our results and practice-based recommendations for the scale-up and rollout of these services. In the context of the male circumcision partnership that we worked with colleagues in Zambia and Swaziland, in a variety of settings. Let's see. So as I said, I'm not going to be talking about all the controversies around the role and the effectiveness of male circumcision and HIV prevention, simply taking it as read and moving on. The focus of our research is on the informed consent procedures for clients arriving at male circumcision clinic sites and undergoing the male circumcision procedures. We looked at assessing the client comprehension and the perceptions of the procedure, and we see those things as being really fundamental to the practice of informed consent. We were asking, what do clients themselves know before they go into the surgery, to the operating theatre? What do they know, what do they expect from the procedure, and what do they think they're agreeing to when they sign the form to say, yes, let's go ahead with the surgery? We want to know how they're expectations before the procedure compared to their experiences after the procedure. And we wanted to use those perspectives to improve the process of informed consent as a whole as the male circumcision interventions roll out on a very wide scale. So just to say a brief couple of words about the methodologies that we employed, both quantitative and qualitative. We started off by administering a comprehension assessment test to clients at the male circumcision clinic sites. We administered a series of true-false statements to the clients and asked them to identify which of these 10 statements were true or false, statements that relate very much to key concepts around male circumcision, about their risk perceptions, about the actual procedures and the healing process. These clients were approached between male circumcision counseling, that is to say they've gone through various procedures of group or individual counseling that may or may not include counseling for HIV testing at some sites, and after they've gone through counseling and before they've gone through the surgery and the informed consent process. And the research question that we were asking, as you can see, is can 90% of these clients pass the comprehension assessment? Pass being we defined as a score of 8 or more out of 10. Our qualitative methods included semi-structured interviews with clients and with various other key informants, and focus group discussions with the parents and the guardians of adolescent clients. Our clients were both adults and adolescents. The cutoff point between the adult and the adolescent group was 17, 18 years old. That's fairly controversial. I'll come back to that if there's time. And we The two research sites were slightly different in their emphasis. The Zambia sample was weighted more towards the qualitative research methods and more towards the adolescent clients. The Swazi sample was weighted more towards quantitative research methods and the adult clients. But that's simply a reflection of the research questions that we and our partners and our funders were asking at each site. In this presentation, I'm going to try and take a step back from those different site-specific circumstances and try to pool all the results to get a bit of a sense of the overall findings from the study in general and to derive some general lessons for service providers who are rolling out these services in various settings on a fairly widespread scale. Now, if I can summarize briefly the procedures that take place at each of the clinic sites and the ways in which our research was fully integrated into some of those clinic protocols. As you can see, I tried to explain briefly, that after the client arrives at the clinic and registers with the clinic reception, there is then a process of introductory counselling about male circumcision, which may or may not include counselling and testing for HIV at that point. At that point, we introduced our first research tool, which was a comprehension assessment, which I had just described. The client then goes on to complete the various other stages of the procedure. There's an informed consent process for surgery that takes place at that point, continues to enter the operating room and undergo the procedure, and goes through a recovery, discharge, and 2 days later is required to attend back at the clinic for a post-op follow-up and another post-op follow-up at 7 days. And it's at that 7-day checkup that we conducted the next stage of our research, which was the client interviews. So that's, if you can see, the way that the research interacted with the clinic procedures. I'm going to go through some of our results. I want to take a look at the results from the perspective of the client and go through these different stages as I've just outlined them. From the client perspective, my focus here is really on the way in which the client comprehends key facts about male circumcision and what they think they're agreeing to when they actually agree. In particular, I'm interested to know, and I'm going to focus a lot on what were the key misunderstandings, what wasn't well communicated, what came as a surprise, because I think all of these things really impact the meaning of informed consent. How can we really say that informed consent has been given when there remain these very key subject areas that are misunderstood or still coming as a surprise to clients afterwards? Informed consent processes here being not just the process of getting a signature on a piece of paper, but really the broader sense of the client's understanding of what's going ahead, education, and so on. Let's see. So starting off with some of the quantitative results, I'm presenting some of the data here from Zambia. I've said site-specific here at this point, but some of it is Zambia. This one's Zambia. Some of them are Swaziland. Let's see. As you can see here, I'm presenting the responses here to the 10 key questions on male circumcision. Overall, comprehension was high and similar between the adolescents and the adult clinics. The pass rate for the comprehension test overall was around 90% for the adolescent clients and 88% for the adult clients, which is fantastic. It's great to see that overall the big picture is promising, and very little, so no statistically significant differences between adult clients and adolescent clinics. However, what's a bit more worrying, and this is where I wish I had one of the little laser pointy things, but if I can draw your attention to number 3, where the data are clearly different, and number 5, there are key differences here. There are statistically significant differences in the results there between adolescent clients and adult clients. And I call your attention to those two in particular because I think it highlights some of the key deficiencies in our ability to meet the needs of adolescent clients. And there's clearly, statement number 3 there relates to client perceptions of the risks of male circumcision, which is a clearly fundamental part of agreeing to the procedure. And statement number 5 there, which is about the prior status of clients arriving for male circumcision, whether clients who are HIV negative or HIV positive can come for male circumcision. So it's important to focus in on these differences because my colleagues and I firmly believe that these represent deficiencies in our communications to our clients, and Ultimately, these deficiencies detract from clients' ability to give true informed consent, and eventually will be putting the clients and their partners at risk after the procedure. So despite these differences that I'm highlighting, it's important to note that clients generally felt well prepared. They received preparatory information about male circumcision, first of all through sensitization and community outreach activities in their villages or in their communities, and then through individual or group counselling at the clinic site. So there's a spectrum of activities going on to prepare clients for the procedures that seems to be doing well. And as you can see, I'm reporting various quotes here, illustrative quotes from the qualitative portion of our research, where that reflects that clients did feel generally well prepared and confident in the steps that lay ahead of them. There was a sense that adolescents were less confident about what was going on ahead of them, and that we're not quite meeting the needs of adolescent clients, and we need to make sure through adolescent-sensitive counselling and education procedures we are meeting the needs of adolescents specifically. So reflecting some of these differences between adults and adolescents, if you look at the figure at the bottom there, it's clear that adolescent clients indicated that they felt significantly less confident in their decision to be circumcised than their counterparts from our adult cohort. And they also reported that predominantly the decision to undergo circumcision had been made before arriving at the clinic. Again, highlighting a deficiency of the informed consent education process here. If the decision is made before the clients even show up at the clinic, what's happening in those community outreach activities to encourage the clients to make their decision? We've really got to broaden our understanding of the informed consent process as starting in the villages, starting in the communities, since these decisions are made even before walking in the clinic. Clients said that they made their decisions influenced by friends and family going on, whether they had agreed or not agreed to circumcision. And that ultimately there was a lot of confusion we detected about the significance of the informed consent form itself, and that the consent procedures, specifically as they relate to minors, the adolescent clients, were poorly understood and inconsistently implemented. And moving on specifically to the different stages of the procedure, and focusing particularly on anaesthesia, because it was absolutely clear that clients felt that injections were the worst part of the process. I mean, it's unquestionable that was one of the strongest findings. Although clients generally had a very good understanding of what they were going to experience during the surgery, they were completely unprepared for the level of pain during the injection itself, the injection of the anaesthetic prior to surgery. And specifically, some of the misunderstandings that they focused on were the number of injections that were administered. They often thought there was going to be one injection, where in fact there could be up to 5 or 6 injections for the procedure. And other reports indicated that some clients, even after the briefings and the counselling and various other educational opportunities, they still believed that the anaesthetic was going to be administered as a general anaesthetic and that they were going to be asleep for the whole procedure. It came as a rather rude shock to note that that wasn't going to be the case. Looking at what happened during the procedure itself, and again, the biggest surprise among clients that we noticed at this stage was that clients were surprised that during the surgery, during the actual cutting itself, clients didn't feel pain, and that part of it was lovely and very promising to note. They acknowledged that the fear of the pain itself had been much worse than the actual pain that they experienced. They also acknowledged that there was a substantial area feel of uneasiness, and a surprise on entering the operating theatre when some of the providers, some of the doctors and the nurses present there were female. And that came as a bit of a surprise to our male clients, and they needed to be better prepared for that, and it made them feel very uncomfortable. I'm going to skip over this aspect of recovery because I think it's implied in some of the other stuff I'll cover. Looking at healing, clients had generally good things to say, that the healing process went smoothly, that it was quicker than they had feared, that it was less painful than they had feared. And they attributed some of the healing progress that they had made to their high motivation to carefully following the wound care instructions. Although they did have various complaints about the pain, especially pain of involuntary erections during the healing period, they had been well prepared with the instructions for wound care. There was a sequence of steps that they were that were given to them, and they were showed great, they were highly motivated, shall we say, to cover these sequence of steps and to make sure that they were healing well. However, there were some concerns that they weren't remembering all the steps and they got confused, especially some of the younger clients needed a bit of support following up on some of the wound care instructions. As I talked about the high motivation for adherence, we also acknowledged the influence of family and friends during the healing process. And again, some of these family and friends are men who have themselves been circumcised, some have not. And it's important to clarify and to make sure that the education messages out there in community are of supportive and to acknowledge some of the traditional aspects, some of the traditional information out there about dealing with the pain and dealing with the healing procedure may not be the messages that we want our clients to be listening to during the healing process. So based on all of these surprises, misunderstandings, perceptions of the informed consent procedures, we derived various recommendations for the practice of informed consent procedures in male circumcision clinics. And in particular, I can't stress this enough, it's important to recognize that the informed consent process begins far before the client enters the male circumcision clinic sites, during the community sensitization and outreach programs, that it's very important to make sure that clients are educated, clients and potential clients, even those who are going to refuse ultimately, must know what they're getting into and make an informed decision. We need to make sure also to publicize the requirements for informed consent for minors. A lot of young adolescents were showing up at the clinics without a parent or legal guardian who would be able to sign the surgical consent form for them. So what do the service providers there do? And that's the subject of a whole other presentation, but suffice to say it's inconsistent and inadequate. We need to make sure that our service providers are better equipped to acknowledge the client fears and to respond to them and to better prepare the clients themselves by conducting refresher training and to train them to expand the counselling to address client fears and key concerns. I just want to note as I close then that our research was guided by international guidance on ethical procedures during research. There's a copy of our burgundy booklet over here of informed consent guidelines. I've put out a bunch of reports and guidance documents here on the table. Please do come and take them because I don't want to schlep them home. The international guidance that we followed held us to a very high standard of accountability and in international research ethics, as it well should. That's not a complaint. However, there was a real disparity between the level of stringency of the international research guidance to the level of stringency of the actual informed consent for surgery that our clients were required to complete. So, for example, how can I describe this? That clients were able to agree to surgery if they, let's say adolescents for example, that the entry barriers to informed consent to surgery were much higher to enter into a focus group than they were to enter into surgery for the client, which is completely backwards and clearly shouldn't be the case. And this is a huge barrier to our research and clearly skews our research sample. But this is one of the difficulties inherent in conducting research into informed consent. And if anyone has any way that they'd like to propose we address this, I would love to have a discussion about that. Anyway, thanks very much to you for listening. Thank you also particularly to the clients, parents, and guardians of the informed consent study.